This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
After the apocalypse, a pandemic survival story. Season 4. Episode 16, Duplicity. The general was talking about duty.
But what exactly does that mean?
Brent thought. Duty to what? Duty to whom? As far as Brent knew, most of the whoms were dead husks, greasy piles of bones in expensive suits, moldering on the floors of Georgetown row houses. Brent's sense of duty was as strong, probably stronger than most men's. He'd fought and bled for his country. Now he wondered what the general was fighting for. Dead men, ghosts, shadows. Was he fighting for himself, or was he striving for something bigger? Was he fighting for an idea? The idea of America. From what Brent could see, there wasn't much left of that idea, and in a generation, it probably would just be a corrupted folk tale told around campfires. Once upon a time, the gods gave George Washington a magic sword. Brent and the general had returned to the bunker uneventfully, after the consolidated meeting of the groups at the campus. These days, any trip that could be described as uneventful was an uncommon blessing. No one died. The choppers didn't crash. No guns were fired in fear or anger. All in all, a good day in the apocalypse. The general had been silent and contemplative on the return trip, which was not uncommon for him. He used words like a scarce commodity and did not waste them. He was of the old school that kept their own counsel. Brent knew this was, at least partly, a leadership tactic, something the general had learned from his mentors while climbing the ranks of an army career. Wasn't it Mark Twain that had said, "It's better to keep your mouth shut and appear stupid than open it and remove all doubt"? Now they were back at the general's office, and the old officer was preaching duty to Brent like a religion. It was the general's baseline, a natural extension of the old-time religion, fire and brimstone, right and wrong demarcation line. There was duty on the one side, the path of right, and betrayal of duty on the other, which was very wrong. There was no middle ground. The best Brent could muster in response was to adopt a mask of normalcy and state emphatically,
"I understand, sir.
He'd smiled and nodded through many a sermon, and this was no different.
Good!
The general focused a look on Brent.
I knew I could count on you.
The general looked away and patted Maisie's flank reassuringly. The pit bull nuzzled at his hand.
One more thing, Captain. Sir, I want you to help that woman, Janet, get settled into one of the other offices. Give her what she needs, but keep an eye on her. And don't give her anything classified without my direct written approval. She's a lawyer. She'll understand that. Yes, sir. And don't worry about these other groups. They'll come around. The cream always rises to the top. Yes, sir,
Brent said once more, his reply being the punctuation at the end of the general's spiel. The general gave him one more quizzical look.
Dismissed. And then, I've got a scheduled update call with one of the other bunkers. Close the door behind you.
Brent turned on his heel, probably more smartly than required, and walked through the door to the outer office. He pulled the door shut until it latched. The tension released at once, and Brent let out a long exhale through his mouth and nose, wondering again, what was the point of all this? It was starting to feel like he was trapped in some ironic BBC war comedy. As he turned to leave, he dropped the pen he had been holding. He reacted by trying in vain to catch it with his foot, but he ended up kicking it instead, sending it skittering along the baseboard to the corner of the antechamber. As he bent to retrieve the wayward writing implement, he could clearly hear the voice of the general through the heating vent on the floor, some quirk of office acoustics. Brent hesitated. He knew he shouldn't eavesdrop, of course, but he was overcome by curiosity. Maybe it was his current skeptical mood. Maybe it was his intelligence training. Whatever it was, he stayed there and listened. The general was in a conversation using the secure continuance of government network. It had been designed just for this purpose. The end of the world. Most people in the modern world had forgotten that the original internet was designed as a distributed communication protocol to have robust government communication, specifically in the case of a nuclear attack. The same distributed network design that had made the modern internet the darling of black turtleneck-wearing computer geeks was also a web of independent nodes that could route the electronic pleas and prayers of a dying world around the dead spots cored out by nuke strikes. No nukes had been thrown, and some of the bunkers were still online and still in a chatting mood. And the general was talking with one of them now. Brent could only hear one side of the conversation, but what drove his curiosity was the general's tone of voice and the way he was interacting with whomever was on the other end. It was, on the one hand, conversational, but at the same time had a conspiratorial edge to it. The general was a real Boy Scout when it came to his words and actions, and that made this interaction strangely different. It held Brent fascinated and unable to walk away from a conversation he shouldn't be listening to in the first place. As he listened, Brent got the mental image of two boys plotting to steal a fresh pie off a windowsill, like in some old Norman Rockwell Saturday Evening Post cover.
Yes, Mr. Secretary. Close to 100 when the new recruits come online. I'd say we'll be a force capable in 6 to 10 weeks, maybe another 4 weeks for weapons system training.
Yes, sir. Can you spare any men?
Advisors or trainers would be ideal, but even a competent fire team would be a godsend.
I understand, sir.
Brent heard the general's voice take on a defensive tone.
No, sir, I don't think there'll be much trouble. If we remove the leadership, the rest will fall in line.
Let me handle that.
I'll keep up the pretense so the natives don't get restless and throw me down a well.
The general laughs for emphasis.
Yes, sir. We don't want a damned whiskey rebellion on our hands, sir.
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
Confirmed. Out.
The creaking sound of the general's chair came through the vent. Brent stood up quickly from his crouch and moved quietly to the outer office door. The general was the only one who could use the COG network to communicate, and that only connected him to other surviving vestigial government entities. But Brent also had a way to communicate with the DC and MAGS now. One of the boomers was a radio enthusiast and had built a radio base station on the hill across from the D.C. It consisted of a mobile home, a tall retractable antenna, and a good-sized generator for power. It wasn't perfect, and it couldn't be used all the time, but would communicate the miles to campus. But it was more than that. It was a beacon in the dark, a portal to connect to anyone who might be left. Each night, at the same time, they switched the radio on at high power and listened for other survivors. Ghostly voices skipped off the ionosphere. A few tentative words were exchanged. There were other survivors out there, flickering lights at a dying world. Helpfully, the same radio enthusiast had equipped Brent with a portable unit. Now, in the right weather, from the high point of the bunker complex, Brent could talk to the D.C., to MAGS. Brent climbed to the building roof at a predetermined scheduled time, clicked a microphone, and called out. For a generation used to digital communication, the quavering voices, static bursts, and meandering fidelity of an analog signal was a foreign thing, but there was less interference in the radio wavelengths now. The chirping garage door openers and invisible dog fences were silent. Brent smiled as Mags's voice emerged from a forest of static, like whale song from the depth.
Queen Bee calling Joker. Over.
Joker Cappy, we got you, Queenie, loud and clear. How's everything going? Over.
Brent answered, happy to hear her voice. He had so much more to say, but would not, could not. Unlike the general's communication setup, this was not secure. Radio was open to anyone who might tune into the wavelength. Not that he expected there would be gangs of sinister ham radio operators in the apocalypse waiting to pounce, or even that any of the other more violent gangs of survivors would have the ability to listen in. But he would still be cautious. He just wasn't sure who he could trust. He missed Mags. Part of him wished he'd stayed on at the D.C. to be with her, but his duty drew him back to the bunker.
"We're busy," Mags replied, "but we're making progress. The bus driver almost has the perimeter wall completed. Over?"
"Great," Brent encouraged.
"What else? Over?" "We started preparing a couple fields for crops. It's late, but we might still be able to get some short growing season vegetables this year. And we found some winter rye seed in one of the farm stores to plant in the fall. Who knows? Maybe we'll be able to bake you some bread in the spring. Over?" "Have you checked with the boomers? One of them is probably a farmer. Over?" "Sure have. They're quite helpful. I've got a professor digging me a fish pond as we speak. Over?"
"It sounds like you've been busy. You're serious about building this farming village. Over?"
"I sure am," she confirmed. "While the rest of you men posture, we'll stay busy building the future from the ground up. Literally. Over?"
Bryn could almost hear the smile through the headphones. Her voice drifted and became robotic with echo. But it was Mags.
"Oh, I almost forgot the big news,"
Mags teased.
"What?"
Brent cut in through a smile of his own, forgetting radio protocol and dropping into a more familiar conversational tone.
"Did you win the lottery?"
"No, we've got livestock,"
she gushed.
"Livestock?"
"Yeah. I've had a crew making sweeps of nearby farms on the map. We've got chickens and a couple pigs and the cutest goats you've ever laid your eyes on."
"You're a regular old Mags Donald now,"
Brent said, and could picture her eyes rolling.
"Don't quit your day job, Joker."
"That's great about the animals," he followed up.
"Just make sure the fence is secure to keep the wolf out. Over?"
He said this with an inflection of seriousness that caused Mags to pause the repartee and consider the metadata in their comms. When she didn't respond right away, he asked,
"Do you understand? Over?
Are there wolves about?"
she finally asked with seriousness.
"There may be. Over?"
he confirmed.
"Well, thanks for the tip. I'll make sure they can't huff, puff, and blow our house down. Over?"
She returned to the frivolity of banter, but he sensed she received a warning.
"Great! I'll find a way to get down and see you as soon as I can. Over?"
He pivoted subjects.
"Did the old man get back from his trip?"
"Not yet, but we expect him soon. When he gets back, he's going to want to come out and check out your facilities. He's like a dog with a bone when he gets hooked into a mission. You'd better make ready, Captain."
"I'll kick around a bit and see what I can set up for him. Thanks for the warning,"
Brent said.
"Thank you as well,"
Mag said meaningfully.
"Over?"
They said their goodbyes, signed off, and let the line drop. Brent didn't know what was going to happen. He didn't know what the general was up to. The best he could do was to warn Mags to be on guard. Janet uncharacteristically fluttered around the office with a broom, chasing clouds of dust into the air. It was a reasonably sized office on the same floor as the general's and had not been occupied for a long time. Brent, knocked on the frame of the open door.
"Good morning,"
he said. "Good morning," she replied. "Just cleaning up a bit." There was an open box on the desk. She had begun filling it with the possessions and mementos of the previous occupant, some mid-level manager whose bones probably now crumbled to dust in the suburbs. A family photo lay face down on top of the open file box.
"Sure. Anything I can get for you?" Brent asked. "The general wanted me to make sure you had what you need. Do you know where I can get rid of this stuff?"
She replied, gesturing to the boxes on the desk and on the floor.
"Just put them in one of the empty offices," Brent replied. "I'll help you,"
he continued, stepping forward and bending to lift a full box of unwanted paperwork from the floor. It occurred to him that the previous resident probably spent their whole lives chasing this paperwork, a life spent chasing paperwork that no one would ever need, a life sacrificed on the altar of bureaucracy, a life now turned to dust. Janet saw him brooding over the box and said,
"For dust you are, and to dust you shall return. Ain't it the truth?"
Brent straightened up with the box and took it out. When he returned, Janet was behind the desk, organizing a stack of notebooks and pens.
"Do any of these computers work?"
Janet asked.
"Yes, there's a local area network and independent power. I'll try to get you user access."
"Great," she said.
"I'm looking for copies of all the state constitutions and scholarly works around them."
He thought about it.
"We'd probably have better luck with a state university."
Brent nodded and sat down on one of the guest chairs.
"You plan to write a new constitution?"
"I don't have a plan yet," she smiled,
"but I do want to understand what previous scholars were thinking. Maybe there is a way, in hindsight, to make improvements."
"I'm not sure the general is going to like anyone trying to improve the constitution," Brent said.
"Yes, I'm sure he's a traditionalist, but we're dealing with a centuries-old document with multiple amendments."
She paused.
"And that doesn't even consider the fact that we've had a full reset with a plague."
She continued,
"I'm sure there are some things we can consider. Whether we like it or not, we're starting over, and we'll need laws that are appropriate to our situation. Laws are nothing more than communal rules that we all agree to enforce by communal will. But it helps to write them down to have a foundational document. Words and documents have power."
Brent listened patiently. He had never felt any of Janet's passion for the law. It seemed just another bureaucratic morass used by double-talking lawyers to get what they wanted. And what they wanted usually was power. Janet sensed his skepticism.
"It's important,"
she said, looking him in the eye.
"We are at a pivotal point in human history. It's imperative that we start with a good foundation. Sure, we can build on the old foundations, but we need to be clear-eyed and proactive in setting the course."
"Seems to me," Brent said,
"the only law we have right now is the law of the jungle. The person making the laws is the person on the business end of the gun."
"That's why we need laws. It's a unifying force. Laws declare right and wrong. Laws are the distillation of the idea that there is right and wrong. People will fight for an idea they believe in, Captain."
I certainly hope you're right, Janet, because I think we're going to see a lot more fighting before we're through.
The king lay in a comfortable bed with clean sheets and feather pillows. They had taken over the best suite in the best hotel in the city. He was feeling stronger now. Soon enough, he'd have his revenge. The crossbow bolt had punctured one of his lungs, but had missed his heart. There had been pain, but for a man whose life was built on pain, it didn't bother him. He'd been shot before. He still had his sharp powers of observation, his analytical mind, his ruthless will. Pain only made him sharper. They got the arrow out, and within a week he was recovering and was able to move around under his own power. Within a month he was almost back to his own self. He had lost men in the battle for the D.C. and to desertions in the aftermath. But he still had a loyal crew of a couple dozen hard who would follow him anywhere. Sure, mistakes were made, and he would address those. But he was still the king.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, my survivor friends, and welcome back. That was episode 16 of season 4. I had to pump this one out early because I'm off on a week's vacation. Yeah, going out to run the Napa Valley Marathon with some buddies and then hang around to see if those studies about how wine positively correlates with healthy outcomes, to see if those are true. First up this week, I ran a quickie poll on Facebook to ask, what should we do during the break between seasons to fill the dead air? Because we got a season ending coming up in a couple of short months. And here I have to pause and remind you that we may have another example of the podcast time travel paradox. I write this at the end of February 2024, so it may not make any sense reply to you when you hear it. But the prevailing sentiment over on the Facebook group was that we should read more stories into audio like we did at the end of last season. So if you are listening to this before the end of, let's say, April 2024, feel free to submit a short story to be read into audio. We will give it consideration and provide editorial feedback. And don't be afraid to submit. Last time we coached more than one first-timer through the process, and we had some real quality output. It was a lot of fun. When we agree on a finished product, we'll get someone to read it into audio. and there's no cost to you. Looking forward to your submissions. I'm going to try to write a couple short stories myself or edit some that I've already written. And you can submit these directly to me at my email, which is cyktrussell@gmail.com. You can also do a submission form on my website, oldmanapocalypse.com, or join the Facebook group and DM me. If I don't answer you, keep trying because you may have ended up in the spam filter. All of these links are in the show notes and on the website. I have not read another book since we last talked, but I did watch some of the 1991 movie Highlander 2 last night. I feel compelled to talk to you about it. This is an epically bad sequel to the beloved science fiction fantasy classic Highlander from 1986. I mean, epically bad. So bad that you want to keep watching. And the movie has good actors in it, too. It's got Christopher Lambert reprising his role, Sean Connery reprising his role, the often villainous Michael Ironsides. Virginia Madsen plays the love interest, because you got to have a love interest. And even John C. McGinley, who I love as an actor. But the script is just incomprehensible. But don't take my word for it. I'm going to quote Roger Ebert of the Chicago Sun-Times, may he rest in peace, gave the film a score of 0.5 stars out of 4, saying, "Highlander 2: The Quickening is the most hilariously incomprehensible movie I've seen in many a long day. A movie almost awesome in its badness. Wherever science fiction fans gather in decades and generations to come, this film will be remembered in hushed tones as one of the immortal low points of the genre. If there is a planet somewhere whose civilization is based on the worst movies of all time, Highlander 2: The Quickening deserves a sacred place among their most treasured artifacts." So in summary, Chris here, I recommend to you that you gather your intoxication of choice and cue this bad boy up. Make a night of it, I dare ya. Highlander 2: The Quickening. According to the internet, they intend to do a direct remake of Highlander, the original Highlander, with Henry Cavill as Connor MacLeod, and this is supposed to start filming in 2024. All I can say is it can't be any worse than The Quickening. All right, folks, that's it for me this week. Remember to get your short stories in for the summer break. Contribute to the show. Give me some money to encourage me to keep going. There can be only one. 550 words. Keep surviving.